Chapter 11 of Joseph, Beloved, Hated, Exalted by F.B. Meyer. Chapter 11. Joseph's Father. Genesis chapter 47, verses 1 to 11. We live in deeds, not years, in thoughts, not breaths, in feelings, not in figures on a dial. We should count time by heart's throbs. He most lives who thinks most, feels the noblest, acts the best. P.J. Bailey. We always turn with interest from an illustrious man to ask about his father and his mother. The father of Martin Luther and the mother of the Wesleys hang as familiar portraits in the picture gallery of our fancy. It is not, therefore, to be wondered at that we find in the Bible something to gratify this innocent curiosity, and especially in the story of Joseph, we are permitted to glance behind the scenes and to consider the relations between him and his old father, Jacob. 1. Joseph's undiminished filial love. From the first moment that Joseph saw his brethren among the crowd of all nationalities that gathered in the corn mart, it was evident that his love to his father burnt with undiminished fervor. Those brethren little guessed how eager he was to learn if the old man was yet alive, nor what a thrill of comfort shot through his heart when they happened to say, "Behold, our youngest brother is this day with his father." Evidently, then, though 25 years had passed since he beheld that shrunken, limping, yet beloved form, his father was living still. And when his brethren came the second time, they must have been surprised to notice the delicate tenderness with which he asked them of their welfare, and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom ye spake? Is he yet alive?" Yes, and Judah little realized what a tender chord he struck, and how it vibrated, almost beyond endurance, to his touch, when he spoke again and again of the father at home, an old man who so tenderly loved the young lad, the only memorial of his mother, that father who had been so anxious lest mischief should befall him, and whose gray hairs would go down with sorrow to the grave unless he came back safe. It was this repeated allusion to his father that wrought on Joseph's feelings so greatly as to break him down. He could not refrain himself. And so the very next thing he said, after the astounding announcement, "I am Joseph," was, "Doth my father yet live?" And in the tumultuous words which followed, words throbbing with passion and pathos, sentences about the absent father came rolling out along with utterances of reconciliation and forgiveness to his brethren. Just as the swollen mountain flood hurries along in its eddies, boulders, timber, and everything that barred the way. "Haste ye, and go up to my father, and say unto him, Thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, tarry not. And ye shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt, and of all that ye have seen, and ye shall haste, and bring down my father hither." The weeks and months that intervened must have been full of feverish anxiety to Joseph, and when at last he heard that the old man had reached the frontier of Egypt, in one of the wagons which, with thoughtful consideration, he had sent to fetch him, he made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel his father. Oh, that meeting! If the old man was sitting in some recess of the lumbering wain, weary with the journey, how he would revive when they said, "Joseph is coming!" I think he would surely dismount and wait, straining his aged eyes at the approaching company, from out the midst of which there came the bejeweled ruler to fall on his neck and weep there a good while. "Let me die," said he, as he looked at him from head to foot with glad, proud, satisfied eyes. "Let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive." I wonder how he felt as he recalled his sad lament, "All these things are against me." But this was not all. Joseph loved his father too well to be ashamed of him. When Pharaoh heard of the arrival of his father and brethren, he seemed mightily pleased, and he directed Joseph to see to their welfare. "The land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any man of activity among them, let them be rulers over my cattle." After this, Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. we cannot but admire the noble frankness with which Joseph introduced his father to the splendid monarch, habituated to the manners of the foremost court of the world. There was a great social gulf fixed between Egypt and Canaan, and the court and the tent, the monarch and the shepherd. And if Joseph had been any less noble or simple than he was, he might have shrunk from bringing the two extremes together, might have feared to recall the comparative lowliness of his origin, might have been ashamed of his relations, who needed to become pensioners on the land of his adoption. But all these thoughts were forgotten in presence of another. This withering, halting, famine-pursued man was his father. There is a great laxity in these respects in all classes of our community, but especially among the children of working men in large industrial towns. The young people are able to earn such good wages as to be largely independent of their parents, and when they have paid some small amount for their keep, they are apt to imagine that their parents have no further claim. They forget the long arrears of obligation. They do not care to remember the cost of those long years of helpless childhood when they were only a burden and a care. They are unmindful of the tender kindness that nursed them through long and dangerous illnesses, that freely sacrificed sleep and rest, that thought them angels, saints, and heroes, and bore with their petulance and fretfulness, or that sat far into the night, contriving dresses, playthings, and other pleasant surprises. In some cases, the behavior of grown-up children to their parents is still more dishonorable. It is a common thing to see men rise in a few years from obscurity to considerable wealth. With increasing money, there comes a vast change in a man's social position. He puts the magic letters ESQ after his name. He lives in a fine house and gives large parties. He keeps his carriage and sends his children to expensive schools. But what of his aged parents? He allows them a meager annuity, but takes care to keep them out of his family and his home, for, to tell the truth, he is rather ashamed of them. It is a false shame indeed, and the man who does so is almost certain, unconsciously, to say or do something which will reveal to his new associates his lowly origin far more readily than the mere presence of his parents at his board could do. I prefer the noble magnanimity of Joseph, who seemed proud to introduce the withered, crippled patriarch to his mighty friend and liege lord. Young people, honor your parents. Do not treat them the worse, just because you know they love you enough to bear with your impertinences. The politeness is mere veneer, which is not gentle to near kin. Do not call them by slang or unmeaning names. Glory in the noble titles, father, mother. They may have their peculiarities and faults, but it is ungenerous and unkind to dwell on them. It is possible to fix your attention on these minor points so as to become oblivious to many noble qualities which are more than a compensation. Imitate the sons of Noah in the filial respect which flung a mantle even over their father's sin. 2. Pharaoh's question. How old art thou? This was Pharaoh's first inquiry as Jacob entered his presence. It was, perhaps, suggested by the patriarch's withered look and bent form. It is a question that often rises to our lips, but it is suggested by a very false standard of estimating the length of a man's life. The length of a life is not measured by the number of its days. No, but by the way in which its days have been used. We live in thoughts, not breaths, in feelings, not in figures on a dial. Some live for many years, and at the end have little or nothing to show for them. Take out the wasted hours, hours of drowsy lethargy, hours of luxurious sloth, and hours of self-indulgence, and only a few hours of real life are left. There are men who will be 70 next birthday, but who have only lived 6 months out of the whole time. It is surprising in Liverpool to see the great bales of cotton compressed under the vast pressure of the hydraulic press, and so lives shrink into a very insignificant space beneath the mighty pressure of reality. Our real life dates not from our first birth, but from our second. All before that counts for nothing. Others live for few years, but they have crowded them with strenuous, noble life. They have been punctual, industrious, methodical. They have redeemed the time. They have treasured the moments with frugal and miserly care. They have made the most of odd bits which others would have flung away as useless, and, as the result, they have much to show. What books they have read, what deeds they have done, what ministries they have set afoot, what friends they have made, what characters they have built up. They have lived long. They will be 30 next birthday, but in those few years they have lived the life which most men live in 60 years. Permit a stranger to ask of each reader, standing in the palace of life, "How old art thou?" How old art thou? 17? That is indeed a critical time. It is a formative time. What thou art now, thou wilt be. Thou art leaving the sheltered bay of early life to launch out into the great ocean. Beware. It is winsome looking, but it is treacherous. Be sure and take on board the great Master, Christ. None but He can pilot thee through the shoals and quicksands which lie hidden on thy course. Take on board none but those whom He chooses as the crew. How old art thou? 21. That is often described as the time of a man's majority or independence. Never forget that there is at least one of whom thou canst never be independent. Thou mayest disown him and go into a far country to waste his substance and thine own in riotous living, but thou wilt have to come back to him at last. There is no true rest or food or honor outside his palace home. Prodigal child, come home, come home. How old art thou? 30. It was at that age that our Lord emerged from obscurity. And think how many men have lived a great life and died before they reached this age. Alexander among generals, Kirk White among singers, McShane and Spencer among ministers. What art thou doing in the world? Come, make haste. Thy life will soon slip away. Take care, lest at the close thou be constrained to say, "I have spent my life in laboriously doing trifles." 'Tis a mournful story. Thus in the car of pensive eve to tell of morning's firm resolves the vanished glory, hope's honey left within the withering bell, and plants of mercy dead that might have bloomed so well. But this need not be your sad retrospect. If only you will yield your whole being to the Lord Jesus, asking Him to keep down your self-life and to think in your brain, to live in your heart, to work through your life, and to fulfill in you the good pleasure of His will, and the work of faith with power. How old art thou? 40? Take care. Very few are ever converted who have reached the downward slopes of 40. If thou art not Christ yet, the chances of thy becoming His lessen at a tremendous ratio every week. How old art thou? 50? 60? 70? The snows are beginning to silver thy head. Familiar pursuits must be abandoned. Familiar places must be visited no more. Affairs once thy pride must be given over to the stronger nerve of others. The dip of yonder path shows how near is the valley of the shadow of death, with its dark, dark river. How art thou going to meet it? Shivering, cringing, cowering, the victim of an irresistible fate, or with brave welcome, such as animated the worn prisoner of the Marmontine dungeon? I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. Old friends, we look on you to teach us how to await our end and how to die. It is a solemn question, how old art thou? It is well to face the growing fewness of our years, to see how envious time is eating away the narrow shoal on which we stand. My favorite piece in all Milton's works is his address to time, and often have I loved to read the passage in Charles Kingsley's Life, which tells how on his dying bed he read it again and again. Fly, envious time, till thou run out of race. Oh, to be able to say that without tremor or misgiving. 3. Jacob's Answer. And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my father in the days of their pilgrimage." They had been few in comparison with those of his ancestors. Terah reached the age of 205. Abraham of 175, Isaac of 180, but the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. They had been evil. As a young man, he was wrenched from his dearest associations of home and friends, and went forth alone to spend the best years of his life as a stranger in a strange land. Arduous and difficult was his service to Laban, consumed in the day by drought, and in the sleepless night vigils by frost. He escaped from Laban with difficulty, and no sooner had he done so than he had to encounter his incensed and impetuous brother. In the agony of that dread crisis, he met with the angel Wrestler, who touched the sinew of his thigh, so that he halted to the end of his life. These calamities had hardly pressed when he was involved in extreme danger with the Canaanites of Shechem, and passed through scenes which have blanched his hair, furrowed his cheeks, and scarred his heart. Thus he came to Luz, and Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and was buried beneath an oak, which was thenceforth called the Oak of Weeping. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and Rachel, his favorite wife, bare a son. And it came to pass, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, the son of my sorrow. A little farther on he came to Mamre, arriving just in time to bear the remains of his own father to the grave. And what sorrows befell him after that have already touched our hearts, as we have studied the wondrous history of his son Joseph. Reuben involved his name in shameful disgrace. Judah trailed the family honor in the mire of sensual appetite. To all appearances, Joseph had been torn to pieces by wild beasts. The dissensions of his sons must have rent his heart, and even after his meeting with his long-lost son, he was to linger for 17 years a pensioner on the bounty of the king of Egypt, far from the glorious heritage which had been promised to his race. Such was the exterior of Jacob's life. Few have trod a path more paved with jagged flints, or bound around their brows a crown more full of thorns. You would have called his life a failure. Compare it with the lot of Esau, and what a contrast it presents. Jacob obtained the birthright, but what a life of suffering and disaster was his. Esau lost the birthright, but he had all that his heart could wish. Wealth, royalty, a line of illustrious sons, these were the portion of his cup. The 36th chapter of Genesis contains a list of the royal dukes of his line. How often must Esau have pitied his brother? My poor brother, he was always visionary, counting on the future, building castles in the air. As for myself, I say, make the best of this world while it lasts. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. And yet when the same Jacob stands before Pharaoh, the greatest monarch of the world bends eagerly to catch his blessing. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. I know that Jacob in his earlier life was crafty, a mere bargain maker, a trickster, but all seems to have been eliminated in the fierce crucible of suffering through which he had passed. And he had reached a grandeur or moral greatness which impressed even the haughty Pharaoh. Esau would never have been able to bless Pharaoh. But this way-worn pilgrim can now do that which his wealthy and successful brother never could have done. Without contradiction, the less is blessed of the greater. Evidently, then, Jacob was a greater man than the greatest monarch of his time. There is, therefore, a greatness which is wholly independent of those adventitious circumstances which we sometimes associate with it. The ermine does not make a judge, a crown does not make a king, nor does wealth or rank or birth make a great man. Jacob was one of the truly great. He was a royal man with a divine patent of royalty. God himself said, "Thy name shall be no more called Jacob, but Israel, a prince of God. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men." Three things made Jacob royal, and will do as much for us. 1. Prayer. On a moorland strewn with boulders, he saw in his dreams the mighty rocks pile themselves into a heaven-touching ladder. This struck the keynote of his life. He ever after lived at the foot of the ladder of prayer, up which the angels sped to carry his petitions, and down which they came, with beautiful feet, to bring the golden handfuls of blessing. Learn to pray without ceasing. It is the secret of greatness. He who is oft in the audience chamber of the great King becomes kinglike. 2. Suffering. His nature was marred by selfish, base, and carnal elements. He took unlawful advantage of his famished brother, deceived his aged father, increased his property at the expense of his uncle, worked his ends by mean and crafty means. But sorrow ate away all these things, and gave him a new dignity. So does it work still on those who have received the new nature, and who meekly learn the lesson which God's love designs to teach them. Do not shrink from pain and sorrow. They come to crown you. The Lamb sits on the throne today because he was slain, and the throne is reserved for those who have learnt to suffer with him, and with him to die. 3. Contact with Christ. There wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Who was he? Surely none less than the angel Jehovah, whose face may not be seen or his name known. It was the Lord himself, anticipating his incarnation and intent on ridding his servant of the evil and weakness which had clung so long and so closely to him, sapping his spiritual life. And from that hour Jacob was Israel. Ah, my readers, be sure of this, that Jesus, the immortal lover of souls, is wrestling with you, longing to rid you of littleness and selfishness, and to lift you also to a royal life. Yield to him, lest he be compelled to touch the sinew of your strength. If you let him have his way, he will make you truly princes with God, and even those above you in the world's rank will gladly gather round you for the sake of the spiritual blessings you shall bestow.